If you're purchasing a new home or refinancing your existing home, then you need to call Team Hochberg, your trusted local lender, 855-563-2843, or visit 56david.com. Lower.com, Equal Housing Lender, MLS 112-4061.
You know, everybody, if you took our advice, you had a great Thanksgiving because you went to Joseph's Finest Meats and got a Yorty turkey, fresh, never frozen. Betty and I did that. There's no other way to go. But now it's time for Christmas. The time now is to make stock. Because I serve on Christmas dinner, it's always Cass onion soup. And the quality of this soup starts with a visit to Joseph's Finest Meats. I just was there the other day. Joseph's Finest Meats, USDA prime, dry-aged beef, homemade sausage. Excellent sausage. We got a couple pounds the other day. And only the finest meats. 7101 West Addison Street, Chicago, Illinois. On Addison and Nordica. Call Joseph's Finest Meats, 773-736-3766, and place your Christmas order. And here's a pro tip from Jeff. Check out the smoked bacon and the maple sausage. Perfect for your Christmas morning breakfast. Joseph's Finest Meats, 7101 West Addison Street, Chicago. Proud sponsor of John Cass News and the Chicago Way podcast. A family tradition since 1977. You've met our friends at Cribby Coffee. It's the good cup of coffee that you want. And now's the time to go to cribbycoffee.com and put your order in for Christmas. They deliver it to your house the way you want it ground. That's K-R-I-B-I-Coffee.com. Check out Cribby's great selection of coffees, including the perfect holiday gifts for that coffee-drinking friend or loved one. I've tried the Holiday Cheers blend, and it's the perfect roast. Or go for the Holiday Trio, a tasty sampler. Whatever you do, make sure you get your order in now. Cribby Coffee, where you can pick your roast, ground your way, and sent to your home. That's K-R-I-B-I-Coffee.com, where I fill my fashionable black and gold Mutza mug, which also makes a nice gift. For all your holiday coffee needs, go to cribbycoffee.com. Proud sponsor of John Cass News and the Chicago Way podcast. Cheers. You know, the other day I went to a funeral. It was in LaGrange, near where we used to live, Betty and I. It was a service, memorial service, for Bruce Dold, the editor and publisher of the Chicago Tribune, when the Tribune was the Tribune. Now I look at it online and I see they're selling it for $1 a year. Oh, thank you. Here's my pennies. I'm not going to give them to you. But there were many people there, people that I've known over the years as I've been a journalist. And I've been trying to put together a lecture for the students at Hillsdale College, will all be up there in February. I think I'd like to open with the Bruce Dold piece because it was really a funeral for journalism in Chicago. I mean, there were all these old men there, old men like me in our 70s and beyond, white hair, old men with their canes or their crutches. And I thought of the news that had been when we cared about it, when Bruce was the editor. He allowed for different voices. That was the old Tribune. He, of course, allowed for conservatives because it was a conservative paper. But he also allowed for liberal voices and was the first to advocate and did endorse Barack Obama as president. Now, we had a little argument about that, but you know, I wasn't going to push it because I respected him. And I'm all about diversity in those days, diversity of opinion, which is not the case anymore in Chicago. You know, Sis Daly died while he was boss, and she had been a lovely lady, the mother of a mayor, the wife of a mayor. And I knew her as the kind and generous lady who would show up at my uncle's restaurant, De La Mar, 35th and Halsted, every day with her lady friends. And what did she order? Tuna fish on toast, chips, and iced tea. That's my Aunt Fanny and my Aunt Betty told me. That's what she ordered every day. She was a lady, they said. And when she passed, Chicago lost something. And then Bruce says, we're going to the wake. And I'm like, no way. I'm not going to the wake. I've been fighting for Daly with Daly for years. And Bruce gave me a look and said, look, listen, John, we're going to the wake. This is Chicago. You go to the wake. And I thought, you know, here's this kid from New Jersey, Bruce Dold, big Grateful Dead fan. I remember when we were writing budget stories together, and the budget of Chicago was only like $4 or $5 billion. Was it now 20? So Bruce says, we're going to the wake. And I didn't want to go because I thought, you know, I'd see Billy and Rich there and all the other dailies and be terrible. But you know what? Bruce may have been born in New Jersey, but he was all Chicago. He married an Irish Catholic girl from my neighborhood, and I'm glad we went together. Because in Chicago, you go to the wake. Drop the feud, you go to the wake. You shake the hand. You look at the person. You say, maybe we had our differences, but I'm sorry. Your mother, father, brother, or wife is gone. And that's what I think of journalism in Chicago. The Bruce Dold funeral was a funeral for journalism in Chicago as it was practiced when we were kids, when you could be a conservative and still have a voice. Of course, they don't allow that anymore at the Tribune, and they don't allow that anywhere in journalism. And so when I write stories like the recent story about Little Mogadishu, the Chicago way, I realize that the Chicago of the awfuls, angry white female leftists, and the newspapers of today would not allow that story, which is why I had to leave. But I'm glad I left. And still, I was sad at Bruce's funeral because he was a man who appreciated diversity and opinion. He didn't shut people down for things they said. He believed in people having an expression. And so I attended the funeral of Chicago journalism, thinking I would just be saying goodbye to my friend. We just ran out of time. I think that's what I'd say to Bruce. We tried, buddy, but we went to the wake. In Chicago, you go to the wake. That was a time when diversity of opinion was appreciated, and now you see, it's not. To talk about that, we're going to have Austin Berg of the Illinois Policy Institute to join us on this podcast. And of course, Jeff Carlin is here, executive producer, WGN Radio, my friend, friend of cats, baker of pies that I don't ever get. Thanks, Jeff, but I don't. I know Betty says he can't give them to me because I'm a diabetic, and I can't eat those pies. But they were lovely and wonderful, and I remember them. And I'm John Cass, executive editor of johncassnews.com. And it's not too late to give the person you love a yearly subscription to journalism that matters to them. And maybe pick up some mugs or Chicago Way mugs with John Cass and Jeff Carlin on them, or have your ball cap with No Chumbalone Zone. Yeah, I'm all about the merch now. And where are you as Chicago spirals out of control, as Brandon Johnson believes in fantasy, as the city's debt grows faster than the icicles on your overhanging eaves? You're on the Chicago Way with John Cass, Jeff Carlin, and today Austin Berg on WGN Plus.
So this is a guy who lives high on the hog, and he has this Tammany Hall style attitude to power. And it's the Chicago Way, absolutely.
Look, the Chicago Way is a deep cultural phenomenon.
It's the Chicago Way.
The Chicago Way. That's the focus.
In a tower by the river, there lived a man. There was a man who took a stand. With pen and paper in his hand, defeating foes in every ward with a pen more mighty than the sword. No escape from his ink lasso in a tower by the river. Castle.
Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago way.
Hey, Jeff. How's your friend Stoop now? Is it cold out there in Chicago?
Yes, it's iced over. It's dibs season is in full effect in Chicago as we battle the Arctic cold. Yeah, it's cold, John. This is like the winters of old. You know, you get like a nice good snow, maybe the last week of November, first week of December, and then you'd have snow all the way until March or April. I feel like we haven't had one of those in a long time.
We need to speak about the cold in like rough Scottish accents as if we were Game of Thrones knights, Knickets.
Yeah. No, I'm good.
We're thinking about the ice walker, the white walkers in the snow, and their blue eyes terrifying us.
I'm just thinking about the snowblower and the shovel and the salt and the sidewalk and getting to the car. That's what I'm thinking about. A lot more real life dangers right in front of me.
I pay for ice and snow removal at my house, which is lovely because Indiana weather is so different from.
Oh, yeah, you're right. When I say lake effect, John, that's John's house. That means John's getting snow. So when you hear that, someone is getting paid to shovel John's driveway. But back in the day, I mean, I grew up as a kid where we were building the square blocks. My dad and my brother and I building an igloo out of blocks because we had so much snow all year. I mean, I feel like that's the way December in Chicago should be. You know, and you were talking about this, John, Mama Daly's sis funeral. What a story there. I mean,
she called me,
Bruce.
Tell
me about that. Cause I'm curious. That's a time, a story that I don't know people, you know, that's behind the scenes. That's the kind of the stuff I'd love to get.
My aunts, Fanny Papikios and Betty Caceres were over at the house when we lived in Oaklawn. Betty was, I don't know whether Betty was going to have the twins or she was pregnant. We had sold our other house and, Thea Fanny and Thea Betty were talking about Sis Daly, like in reverent terms, because I was writing about her. She had saved the cultural center, the library, Chicago Public Library, beautiful building on Randolph. She had saved it from the developer's wrecking ball. And she just asked her husband, Richard J., the real boss, the real mayor, to save it. And then she called my house when Thea Betty and Thea Fanny were there, and they were talking about Sis Daly. And she said, "Hey, hello, John." And I knew it was her right away. I didn't know what to say. And she said, "Listen, do me a favor. Don't make a big thing about me." Because I was saying we should give her something. We should name the building after her, you know, because she saved it. She's like, "No, don't make a big thing. You know what? It's the way we were all raised in the south side, southwest side of Chicago, right around the stockyards. Don't act big. Never act big. Like a big talker." Yeah. She's like, "Please let it go." Now, what was I to say to that? I said, "Okay, Mrs. Daly." She goes, "Please." And then later on when she died, Bruce is like, "Don't even try to get out of this, you know?" So we went to the wake.
Where was this?
It was at Nativity, I believe. Mm-hmm. Great old Catholic church. It was crowded, you know?
Sure.
Because she was royalty. She was the queen of Bridgeport. Unlike her daughter-in-law, the Bridgeport couldn't stand her. They really didn't like the daughter-in-law. But they loved Sis. Mm. And Rich was there, and Billy, and Johnny. There's three of them standing there, John Daly, Richard M. Daly, and William Daly, and other members of the family, and retainers, family retainers, cops, and city workers, and political workers, you name it. And they're all there. And I'm glad I went. Just as I'm glad I went to that wake for Bruce Dold, the New Jersey kid who told me in Chicago, we always go to the wake. I had to hear that from a New Jersey kid. And he's right. Chicago, you go to the wake. Wow.
So I'm imagining a full church and you and Dold kind of just like slide in the back and you're standing in the back of the room watching this. I mean, what?
No, we went up. She was, her casket was open.
Mm-hmm.
It was visitation too. And so in those days, I didn't need a cane to walk. I was able to walk. It was crowded. We walked right up to the casket and then there was Rich and he was looking at me.
Mm.
He nodded and he said, mouth the words, thank you.
Oh,
we all love our moms.
Yeah.
If we're lucky, yeah. You know, and there's nothing that I ever did or said, you know, to anger her, at least not about her.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, she loved her son, you know, but you know, that was her plain spoken iced tea, tuna fish on toast and chips with her lady friends. She was unassuming. She never ever acted like Maggie Daly, you know, like the Queen of Sheba.
Yeah.
She never did that.
But she wasn't.
I'm sorry?
I said, who has a whole park named after her, you know, that had its own Chicago Way genesis.
Yeah. Someday we'll tell that story, but not today.
Yeah. No. This is one of the things I talk about all the time, is that we have so much more in common than not with everybody. And just this awful vitriol that just permeates everything, that just amplified in these echo chambers that we live in. I couldn't imagine that now. You know,
it wouldn't be bad if I just got on my knees and kissed the hem of the Tribune Guild's garment, but I won't do that. And I think now you're seeing people saying openly things that many of us are saying.
That's exactly what I was referring to, but I mean, it's along the same lines, but this idea that and no matter what you say, I mean, you could say anything to the Tribune and it wouldn't matter, Tribune Guild, because they're John Cass and, you know, in their mind, you're the enemy. It's that's
what. But I mean, what about you? I would say that you're reasonably a progressive, moderate. But even you would be denounced by these people. Right. Exactly.
Oh, sure. I mean, well, yeah. I mean, a lot of things that any support for Paul Vallis I've given would have been denounced by them or mentioned or any critique of them. Yeah, absolutely. And it's sad. I mean, I couldn't see, other than in an absolutely performative fashion, you know, a funeral for the mother of a contested or an adversarial person in anyone's mind, which is everybody apparently now these days, if you don't, you know, not wearing the same colors and talking the same way and all that, I couldn't see that happening like that. You know, I couldn't see, I don't know. It's hard to really envision a time when people would come together. Cause I thought the pandemic would have done that because craziness was happening. I would have thought we had, you know, wars that would happen, attacks on bombings and murder and all sorts of reasons that I think people would come together.
This won't end. It won't end until one side is eradicated. Now, if I lose, if the people on my side are eradicated, like you see what's going on in Europe, if you speak your mind, you're going to jail. You know, you don't like Islamofascism, you're going to jail. Here in this country, we're about a few months away from that.
Yeah, I disagree. I agree with your sentiment that it's off. It's diabolical that would be the where the places like the UK are. I don't think we're in any risk of falling into that just because we're too litigious and it's too easy to sue someone and too easy to make it run it through the courts. And nothing would stand up to that, I don't think, but I do not like, you know, with that, it's a possibility, you know, it's never even having a conversation, John. It's wild.
You don't like to see it. I'm just telling
you're
you
right.
That I'm thinking about what Christopher Hitchens, remember him?
Mm-hmm.
He was a British intellectual and he was so progressive. He was like not even a Democrat. He was a communist or on the hard left. But he loved tradition and he loved common law. He loved the idea of British people speaking their minds. And he warned us of what would happen. And we're seeing it now. So,
yeah. But we're two different places. I mean, the UK is different in its laws and its rules, and it doesn't have a constitution like we do that protects a lot of these things. That's why I'm not, you know, we're not a couple months away. I mean, that's
okay, not a couple months away. And they do have great traditions. I'm going to follow one. I'm going to serve Sunday roast on Christmas Day.
I love it.
That I'm getting from Joseph's Finest Meats.
Oh, good choice.
It's going to be great.
Well, I mean, this is the thing, I think maybe we're getting to the point where some of the thread has run bare on the camouflage that these, you know, as you call them, and I agree, socialists that are trying to push this country into that world, because they have no real answers to anything other than that everybody should be happy and get everything they want, and nobody should have any more than anybody else.
Right.
And they've gotten elected into positions in New York, and I mean, as we can see in Chicago, and they haven't done anything right. And in Chicago, Brenna Johnson's is just driving the city into debt day after day and coming up with the most ridiculous ways to try to fix a budget that has to be done by the end of the month, or else the city shuts down.
We'll see what happens. But I'm glad Austin Berg is here to talk about
it. And so to give us an update on that, as this stuff stands on Monday before the week before Christmas, it's a lot of skullduggery. So strap in.
Okay, as promised, here's Austin Berg, Executive Director of the Chicago Policy Center at the Illinois Policy Institute. I've got a question. I was just at a party the other day with at Tom Servant's house. We had journalists and politicians. And you know what everyone was talking about as we ate L. Lerner's wife's lovely brownies? We're talking about who's the next mayor of Chicago. Who's it going to be? Austin, help me out.
I think this is one of our Chicago pathologies as Chicagoans, and I call it this is called the waiting for Superman syndrome. The conversation at every holiday party is who you got, who's the guy, who's the girl. It's almost like gambling. And I think Poly Market has not shown up yet, but as soon as that prediction market goes up, I'm deferring all of my questions to that market. But I think the field is will be, you know, it'll be the Kentucky Derby. There'll be, you know, probably more than a dozen candidates. But I often try to tell people it's we have to not just talk about who's going to be the new mayor. That's like a necessary but not sufficient condition to fix the city. We have to pick our heads up and look to other big cities for solutions, not just the new mayor.
Maybe we could go for inspiration. Go to Minneapolis. That's a well-run city, is it not?
I don't know. I wouldn't put Minneapolis as well. While it is close by, I wouldn't put it as one of our peers. I don't think it's even in the top 30 cities by population. I think a good example that recently came up of how we can create a new pathology of picking our heads up and looking elsewhere is the city treasurer, Melissa Conyers-Irvin, who made national headlines for saying that we should divest from U.S. treasuries. Hmm. Basically the most stable asset you could hold in the world. And that raised a great conversation on what the heck does the city treasurer do anyway? And in Chicago, we are very unique in that our treasurer's office does not, like it does in New York and LA, have the power to audit city departments, to offer meaningful input on the city budget and independent analysis of the city budget. Instead, we have these three citywide officials, the clerk, the treasurer, and the mayor. And the mayor is the only one that has any power, and that person has all the power. Meanwhile, the clerk, you know, handles your city stickers, and the treasurer makes sort of political proclamations. They don't do anything of substance. So that's something you don't need necessarily a city charter to change. You could change that through ordinance, the responsibilities of those offices.
There's plenty of jobs for all these political hacks if we just can pay our bills. But as Jeff Carlin has mentioned many times, and you and others, we're not paying our bills, and we're facing how much in debt. As we speak, the city council is gathering together to have another emergency meeting. How much debt Are they facing?
All right. And then to be clear, too, Austin, set the table, too. People may not follow it closely, but this is the budget for Chicago. There's a deadline. The mayor's been throwing, you know, crap at the wall left and right for months saying, oh, we're going to fix it with this or we're going to fix it with that and maybe this. You know, it's kind of feeling the room, and his latest thing's been the head tax and all that. But give us the 411 on it. It's where it stands today.
Certainly. Well, just in terms of our debt, the pension systems by themselves have over $50 billion in debt in Chicago. These are the overlapping pension systems that cover the city. That's more debt than 44 U.S. states that we have, just as a city. So, I mean, obviously, that's the elephant in the room, and that's really what's producing these deficits year after year after year. And right now, we have an unprecedented situation in the current budget season. So we have until the end of the year to pass a budget, and the mayor has really proposed what I would describe as a political budget. And the key element of this political budget is the head tax. So charging a tax for every single job that you employ or that you create as an employer in the city of Chicago. If you guys recall, I think this was last year, there was a $300 million property tax hike proposal from the mayor, and the City Council took the first ever 50-0 vote against the mayor on the $300 million property tax hike, and they said, "Oh no, let's bring it down to 150. Let's bring it down to 50. Let's bring it down to 20." And it was no down the board. And the same thing is happening with this head tax. So it was at first it was going to be, I believe, $22 for every employee per month if you employ over 100 people. Now it's just over 500 employers with over 500. Jobs in the city of Chicago, charging them $33 a month. We would be a severe outlier on that, much, much, much higher than any other big city in the country, most of which do not charge a head tax at all. But the point is not, you know, comparing ourselves to other cities. The point is purely so the mayor, when he goes and runs for re-election starting next year, he gets to say, "I tax the rich." And but at the end of the day, it's a tiny drop in the bucket. Even this new proposal, it would generate about $80 million. And for context, the city budget is around $17 billion.
Unbelievable.
So it's a drop in the bucket. But it matters because of what it signals to one, employers in the city and the rest of the country. But two, to Johnson's progressive base, and that's why he's fighting so hard for it.
You know, Jeff, it's like. If you ever wondered what it sounded like from the inside of a barrel, as the insane people would go over the barrel in at Niagara Falls, this is what it sounds like right now.
And you're right. I mean, Austin, he's going to label this as a win. But let me get this straight: we wanted $300 million to fix some things, or in tax, you know, raise in revenue to fix some things. And there was this big plan that we have got to do something about the downtown because there aren't any businesses down there anymore. So they're throwing all these ideas about building, you know, low income housing in these office building, and they're trying to do that. It's a drop in the bucket, like you said. So. They've pushed all the businesses out have left, and now they're trying to scramble to fix the hole that's left, and now they're going to try to push more businesses out. I mean, how is anybody making a case for this?
Again, it's a political talking point, which is we're going to tax the quote unquote ultra rich. But you're right that it's at cross purposes with the entire rhetoric about bringing back downtown, because guess who's exempt from the head tax? Remote workers. Mm-hmm. So at a time when we want to get as many people back into the downtown core as possible, you know, it's the worst possible time to put this head tax on the books. And when asked, what other big cities are you looking to for inspiration on this head tax, the mayor could not name one. and Marianne Ahern came back. She asked that great question. And then the mayor came back a couple days later and he said, "Yo, I have an answer to your question. The other big city I'm looking to is Chicago, but, you know, in the 80s when we had this head tax." And of course, the big difference between now and the 80s, there's many, but one is that people work remotely and the downtown core has changed substantially. And all of our other tax burdens have gone up by a lot in the city of Chicago. So the head tax is just it should be dead on arrival. I do not think he's going to be able to get it, which, again, is unprecedented for a mayor to not get this stuff. That's the new moment we're in.
I don't know how anybody has any confidence in them. And they got to get this done before the end of the year, one way or another. Otherwise, there's a shutdown. What fix can, I mean, what's the first step for them?
Well, there's a number of things that we have to do structurally, and those are longer term. And then there's things that you can do just in this budget year. And encouragingly, this is another completely new thing. There's a majority block of the city council that says, this guy's driving us off a cliff. We need to be more responsible. And they've put forth an alternative budget that is by no means perfect. It still hikes taxes and fees, but it at least asks for the government unions to pay in a little bit more, especially on healthcare, which the mayor has refused to do. He's asked everybody else to put skin in the game except for government sector unions. And it has a couple of other just basic good budgeting practices, like not borrowing to pay for operations.
Yeah.
And that budget is moving forward. There's going to be several hearings this week where we can expect perhaps even a vote to get that out of committee and onto the city council floor. So that's really encouraging from the short term. In the long term, you got to look at things like what I was saying before. Why is the treasurer should be an independent elected official that actually has some sway on the budget, that is able to give independent analysis? The city council should have its own independent budget office, as many other big cities do, so that it's actually a legislative branch. It's not just a rubber stamp for the mayor. It is remarkable. It's remarkable that this city council block has been able to put forward anything. They don't have staff that knows any of this stuff or works on it, so they've had to tap other people.
Scott Wuxpeck has called for years. I remember when Lori Lightfoot denied him. I don't know why the executive branch can deny the legislative branch anything, but this is Chicago, and she was the boss, and she said no.
Yeah.
But I mean, they need an independent financial authority in the city council.
That's right. And we looked at this in our book, The New Chicago Way, with thanks to Mr. Cass for popularizing the Chicago Way. The three fiscal firewalls for big cities, one being independent elected controller or treasurer, two being robust city council involvement budgeting, and three, voter approval for tax hikes and new debt. Chicago is the only big city in the country that has none of those three firewalls. So then we wonder, how do we get into this mess? And that third point, I think, is really important because, you know, having those political guardrails are great, but ultimately accountability comes from voters actually getting to decide, have the politicians earned our trust enough to give them new borrowing powers or to give them new taxing powers? And what we found in Chicago and statewide is that voters are willing to, you know, in the suburbs, pass a new, you know, borrowing plan to create a new swimming pool for the school or something, if the school's making a good case. But if the city's not making a good case, like in the Bring Chicago Home fight or Governor Pritzker with the progressive tax, voters are smart enough to say, no, come back to us with a better plan. So I think that's actually the most important thing here. So you got to get voter approval on these new tax hikes and new debt.
That's the Chicago way, indeed. I still can't get over the head tax idea and this guy saying, the 80s. Well, does anybody remember the 90s, what the downtown looked like in the late 80s, early 90s and on? I mean, it wasn't a great place in mm-hmm. head tax to think. You mentioned Pritzker in this and the progressive tax. What's going on there? There's some sort of rumbling to try to push a new tax frame that would, you know, tax eat the rich, as they say. What's going on there? Have you heard anything on that?
Well, I will say the governor came out almost immediately saying the head tax is a bad idea, as did House Speaker Welch, which is a big deal. And this is, I think, emblematic of shift that we've seen, another unprecedented shift. We just saw TV ads over this weekend where you have folks on the political left bringing up the CTU and its corrupting influence, and going after Brandon Johnson and his poor governance.
And highlighting Mr. Potter.
Mr. Potter, that's right. Jackson, I was just in the office this morning and someone told me, Austin, has Jackson Potter ever been in a television ad before? And I said,
I don't think so.
Besides our documentary, Local One, I don't think there has been citywide attention on Jackson Potter.
And what happens now?
Well, I think at the state level, to your question, Jeff, I don't think that there is appetite to go try to take another bite at the apple. Illinois, one of our only pro-growth, pro-taxpayer policies that is instantiated in our Constitution is our flat income tax. And the flat income tax is good, not because an income tax is necessarily good, but because it's flat, which means that it's politically difficult to hike it. because it has to go up on everybody. And in 2020, the governor spent more than $50 million trying to undo that flat tax protection, and he was not able to. And that was really, I think, one of his only real public embarrassing losses in the entire course of his governorship was that vote. So I don't think there is a huge appetite to go and do that again, even though, you know, you have nationwide increasing rhetoric, progressive rhetoric around soaking the rich, eating the rich.
Wow. And for those who don't know, Jackson Potter, the CTU president, and who was born an activist. It's
his mommy's a lefty who ran a law firm, and I think still does, and made a lot of money with Chicago Public Schools, as per the great documentary that Austin's referring to from Illinois Policy, Local One, which is, I think, probably worth seeing again, don't you think,
yeah,
Austin?
We might need to do a new chapter. Yeah, and folks can watch it at chicagoteachersunion.com because we have that domain.
Which I love every time.
Listen, guys, we've been so solicitous of Austin's advice that we didn't want to break into our old pathologies, but people want to know who's going to be the next mayor. Is it going to be Alexi Janulis, who's lying on the couch kicking his little socks in a sort of pose like a 13-year-old girl, not like a Greek? Or is it Susana Mendoza, who wants to be mayor? Or is it Treasurer Maria Pappas, who's, unlike Alexi, she actually does have a pair and wants to be mayor? So what are we going to see here?
One, it's encouraging to me that we're going to see an unprecedented level of new ideas emerge out of this mayoral field from a variety of candidates. And that's going to be really exciting to watch. Yeah. If you had to handicap the race, though, I think in the top three spots, you would have to put Janulis, Mendoza, and then Brandon Johnson. And because those three officials have the highest name ID, Mendoza, I believe, is the highest total vote getter in Illinois in the last election. So those I would say you have to put in the top three because of their ability to raise money, their high name ID. And for Brandon Johnson, getting into the runoff, he will be relying really, really heavily on Black Chicagoans. And he right now kind of has an open lane in that respect. So you'd have to put those folks in the top three, and then the field,
I agree,
is in the fourth spot.
But the conflict for Brandon, Mayor Panic Attacks himself, is that Black voters are upset with the way he spent hundreds of millions of dollars on illegal migrants, most of them Latino, and what they wanted was taken away. So they didn't get anything.
Right.
Yeah.
And their property taxes have gone up, even though that's not him directly. I mean, it is, and it's going to be a tough road. I think that's a pretty good top three. I think Pappas is going to make it the most entertaining, though, because she is such a wild card.
She's got the nuts for it. Yeah, she's unlike Alexi.
Maria Pappas, I will say, she's gotten a lot of ink the last few weeks because her office put out a great report when those property tax bills hit. And we saw in Chicago a 17% increase in residential property tax bills in just 1 year. And that's the biggest increase in 30 years. And I thought what was great about her report was showing part of the reason for that was this decline in commercial property values in the Loop, which again highlights, you know, this really bad dynamic with the head tax. We need to encourage folks to come back downtown. We need to encourage those property values to keep rising in the commercial core. One thing that report left out, though, which I think is one final element of the budget discussion worth having, because it isn't covered very much, are TIFs, tax increment financing districts.
Slush funds.
Johnson's proposing a $1 billion sweep of those.
Yeah.
And the biggest chunk goes to Chicago Public Schools, over $500 million. Out of those development funds. They're supposed to go towards economic development. I will argue all day long about whether those are even, you know, necessary or good for economic development. There's been a lot of silly projects funded by TIF, some worthy projects funded by TIF, But the important part about TIF and all of that money that would go directly to the Chicago Teachers Union and Chicago Public Schools is that that money is not subject to our property tax caps. So if Chicago Public Schools wanted to get all of that property tax revenue by itself, it would have to go to voters to get that approved, just like we were talking about before. But by using this TIF end around, basically putting property values into these TIFs, extracting them, and then running them back into the system, it's almost like money laundering, they get to avoid the voters. And that, I think, is a really critical part of the budget discussion that gets lost.
I agree. And I think that your analysis is spot on throughout this conversation.
Yeah, thanks, Austin. It's always good to tap you, the big brain of yours.
Austin Berg, the big brain. Yeah.
Thanks, Austin.
Thanks, Austin.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it.
For Austin Berg, Executive Director of the Chicago Policy Center at the Illinois Policy Institute, and for Jeff Carlin, the aforementioned executive producer, WGN Radio, the finest producer in radio, and for me, John Cass, editor of johncassnews.com, proud author of a rather controversial piece, Little Mogadishu, The Chicago Way. Join us again next time on the Chicago Way podcast on WGN+.